President Truman appointed Lilienthal chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission and, as required by Congress, he created a General Advisory Committee, GAC, to assist the AEC commissioners. Despite Truman's dislike of Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb could hardly be kept off such a committee. So, following the recommendations of a variety of advisors, Truman appointed him together with I.I. Robey, Glenn Seaborg, Enrico Fermi, James Conant, Cyril S. Smith, Hartley Rowe, a Los Alamos consultant, Hood Worthington, a DuPont company official, and Lee DeBridge, who had recently been appointed president of Caltech. Truman left it up to these men to choose their own chairman. But when a news report wrongly implied that Conant would chair the committee, Kitty Oppenheimer huffily asked Robert why he hadn't been named chairman. Robert assured his wife that it is not a major issue. In fact, DeBridge and Robey were quietly lobbying behind the scenes for Oppenheimer. By the time the GAC gathered for its first formal meeting in early January 1947, the fix was in. Delayed by a snowstorm, Oppenheimer arrived late to learn that his colleagues had unanimously elected him their chairman. By then, Oppie was disillusioned with both the Soviet and American positions. Neither country seemed prepared to do what was necessary to avoid a nuclear arms race. As a result of both the broadening of his despair and his new responsibilities, his views began to change. That January, Hans Bethe came to visit him in Berkeley, and Oppie confessed in several long conversations that he had given up all hope that the Russians would agree to a plan. The Soviet attitude appeared inflexible. Their proposal to ban the bomb seemed designed to deprive us immediately of the one weapon which would stop the Russians from going into Western Europe. Bethe agreed. Later that spring, Oppenheimer used his influence as chairman of the GAC to toughen the American negotiating position. In March 1947, he flew to Washington, where Acheson gave him a preview of the president's soon-to-be-announced Truman Doctrine. "He wanted me to be quite clear," Oppenheimer later testified, "that we were entering an adversary relationship with the Soviets, and whatever we did in the atomic talk, we should bear that in mind." Oppenheimer acted on this advice almost immediately. Soon afterwards, he met with Frederick Osborne, Bernard Baruch's successor at the United Nations atomic energy negotiations. To Osborne's surprise, Oppenheimer told him that the United States should withdraw from the UN talks. The Soviets, he said, would never agree to a workable plan. Oppenheimer's attitude toward the Soviet Union was now following the general trajectory of the emerging Cold War. By his own account, during the war he had already begun to turn away from his left-wing internationalist enthusiasms. He was also troubled by a speech Stalin gave on February 9, 1946. Oppenheimer, like most observers in the West, characterized it as a reflection of Soviet fears of encirclement and their need to keep their guard up and to rearm. In addition, he was disheartened by what he was learning about Soviet wartime espionage. According to an FBI informant, identified as T1, an administrator on the Berkeley campus, Oppenheimer returned from receiving a 1946 briefing in Washington terribly depressed. T1 reported that an unnamed government official had given Oppenheimer the facts of life concerning the communist conspiracy, and as a result, Oppenheimer had become thoroughly disillusioned with communism. The briefing Oppenheimer received pertained to a Canadian spy scandal precipitated by the defection of Soviet code clerk Igor Guzenko, which led to the arrest of Alan Nunn May, a British physicist working in Montreal who had spied for the Soviets. Oppenheimer was genuinely shaken by this evidence of treachery on the part of a fellow scientist, and later that year, when the FBI came to interview him about the Chevalier affair, he commented on the fact that often communists in various countries outside of the Soviet Union could be led into situations where they would be acting, either knowingly or unknowingly, as spies for the Soviet Union. He could not reconcile the treachery employed by the Soviets in their international relationships with the high purposes and the democratic aims ascribed to the Soviets by the local American communists. The failure of the Baruch plan had made things worse. The dream of international control would have to await a change in geopolitical circumstances. He understood now that the ideological differences between the United States and the Soviet Union were unlikely soon to be reconciled. "It is clear," he told an audience of Foreign Service and Army officers in September 1947, "that Even for the United States, proposals of this kind, international controls, involve a very real renunciation. Among other things, they involve a more or less permanent renunciation of any hope that the United States might live in relative isolation from the rest of the world. He knew that the diplomats of many other countries were genuinely goggle-eyed at the sweeping nature of his proposals for international control. They involved radical sacrifices and at least a partial renunciation of sovereignty. But he now understood that the sacrifices required of the Soviet Union were of another order of magnitude. In a perceptive analysis, he noted, "That is because the proposed pattern of control stands in a very gross conflict to the present patterns of state power in Russia. The ideological underpinning of that power, namely the belief in the inevitability of conflict between Russia and the capitalist world, would be repudiated by a cooperation as intense or as intimate as is required by our proposals for the control of atomic energy. Thus, what we are asking of the Russians is a very far-reaching renunciation and reversal of the basis of their state power." He knew that the Soviets were not likely to take this great plunge. He had not given up hope that in the distant future international controls could be achieved. In the meantime, he had reluctantly decided that the United States had to arm itself. This had led him to conclude, with considerable melancholy, that the principal job of the Atomic Energy Commission would be to provide atomic weapons, and good atomic weapons, and many atomic weapons. Having preached the necessity of international control and openness in 1946, Oppenheimer by 1947 was beginning to accept the idea of a defense posture supported by a multitude of nuclear weapons.